What up, internet? This your boy, Hennessy Youngman, a.k.a. Han Rock Obama, a.k.a. the Pharaoh Hennessy. You know what I'm saying? I've been getting a lot of emails from many of you that basically saying, you know, Hennessy, I have no artistic talent whatsoever, yet I'm compelled to want to make art. And first off, internet, I want to express my displeasure with your use of such antiquated terms like talent and making. You know, I mean, internet, who you think you is, internet? You know, Brancusi? Come on now. That's crazy. You talking crazy and reckless right now, internet. Just the future, internet, and talent ain't got naught to do with artistic production. You know what I'm saying? Art can be made out of everyday objects. And this is a pretty old trick, you know what I'm saying? But it's still very, very doable in this age of internet based artistic type productions. You know what I'm saying? As long as that everyday object doesn't serve an actual function within society, then you could be elevated to the realm of art. You know what I'm saying? In this kind of work, you don't really want to call it an artwork. You want to call it a proposition. You know what I'm saying? It has the possibility of being art. You know what I'm saying? This is a question about art, you know, a query, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, there's no such thing as a bad question, you know what I'm saying? Just bad answers. And your art is not an answer. Make sure you say it's exploring something or challenging or investigating. But don't say it's solving anything, all right? You know, so that's... So, yeah, internet, that's it. Don't fret. If you can't make these types of arts, then there's always video art. And that's it. Peace. One love.
All right. Shall we?
Yes.
Hey, everybody. It is your Lucky Paper Radio for the week. I'm Andy, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony. Probably not a robot, Maddox.
Probably not, but you never know.
Probably not. I mean, as best we can tell...
Every
if you
time,
are a robot,
every time
you're very
we meet,
sophisticated.
You show me a CAPTCHA, and I have to click on all the buses, and it's really frustrating. It's difficult being friends with you, Andy, but I understand you just want to keep out the robots.
I just got
to
know. It's actually prescient that you you said that. Did you see that message I posted earlier in our Discord channel?
No, you told me not to, specifically.
Well, yes, you saw the message telling you not to see the other messages,
yes.
Right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay, cool. I'm just going to ask you to reveal these one at a time. I sent some spoilered messages to Anthony.
It's really kind of
Anthony.
The rudest thing you could possibly do to,
what?
To another human being.
What, to produce the show? To come up
Say,
with bits for our
click,
podcast?
Don't click on these things.
Yeah, I did kind of do like a don't think about zebras thing
uh-huh.
to you.
Shoot,
but,
I just lost the game.
Now you're all
Crap.
Losing the game. You all lost
oh,
the game.
Man.
Thousands
it's,
of
I've,
you.
I had a couple year streak going there, I think.
Yeah, it's been a minute for me,
Oof.
Too.
Well, sorry to all you out there who just lost the game.
Anyway, yeah, I know it's pretty tempting to let you not click the messages. But yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and ask you to click on these one by one and just read them for me.
Okay, here we go. Message
go
one. The old man, wait, the old man, the boat. I feel like there's some words missing there.
Okay, hit the next one.
The complex houses married and single soldiers and their families.
All right, hit me with that third one.
The horse raced past, the barn fell.
You know what these are?
Nope. I have no idea.
These are called garden path sentences. Each one of these is, in fact, a complete, grammatically correct, no words missing sentence. Have you figured out the trick? You like this bit where I try and trick you on air?
Yeah, this is a great bit. I'm loving this art that we're making. The old man, the boat. I don't... There's... The old man, the boat. As
there
in
we
old
go.
People, the man is not a noun here.
Yes.
It is a verb. Okay, and we
yes.
keep... I'm bored.
You're bored? The next one is the complex.
Uh-huh.
Houses married and single soldiers and their families. The complex is the noun, not an adjective describing houses. And then the last one is the horse raced past the barn fell. It's the horse which raced past the barn fell.
The horse... Raced past the barn. The horse raced past the barn?
Raced past
it's
the
not...
barn is describing the horse.
The horse, not racing, I guess past as a past thingy. Man,
which
I don't
horse?
Know.
Which horse?
I don't. I
the
don't,
horse raced past the barn.
There are usually not that many horses in my life that I need to disambiguate them in this way.
Yeah, I just found out about these today from a friend, and I thought they were very fascinating. And part of what these are used for... maybe not used for, but an interesting application of these is testing large language models, because as you might imagine, AI particularly bad at analyzing these sentences. So I think in some cases, humans are worse in some sentences, and AI is better because, you know,
it doesn't have the expectations. It's like, here's the... I mean, not that this is not exactly how AI works, but using a metaphor for how a computer program could work, it might just have an entry for old. That can be either a... Man can be a noun or
the
a verb
old man the boat
easily, whereas a human being might just be like, I never use this as a verb, so they might just have, you know, expectations that
I mean,
yeah,
the what
off.
Is a large language model if not a bunch of expectations for what's going to come next and what came before it, right?
Wow.
Big anyway, thoughts. They're mostly bad at these things. I'm going to put a couple links in the show notes to the Wikipedia page for garden path sentences, as well as an article about why AI is bad at parsing them. This is a indulgent episode of the podcast, Anthony. It's not going to be about magic much at all. It's not going to be about cube literally at all. I have some art thoughts, and I want to talk about art with my friend Anthony.
Okay.
This is like loosely spurred on. So, Sam of Ristic Studies, at time of record, let's timestamp this bad boy. It is Wednesday, March 6th, 5:50 p.m. Eastern. And at time of record, unless he published it in the past couple hours, Sam of Ristic Studies has teased that his next video is going to be about the infamous Carly Mazur. I actually don't know how to pronounce her last name. Sorry, Carly. The illustration from the Strixhaven Mystical Archives Faithless Looting, which is that illustration of like the figure with like kind of blocky, almost like paper cutout shapes around it that is not really in your classic magic art style that has a lot of detractors, let's say. A lot of people really don't like this art and think it looks unfinished or bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird contrast in that there are some very like highly rendered parts of the painting that, you know, are the person's body looks like it has a lot of shadows and dimension.
When I first saw it, the body honestly looked like a photo.
Right.
It looks like really it was a Photoshop rendered collage, and then you get closer, you're like, actually, no, that is a painting. Just very carefully painted and rendered forms.
It reminds me a lot of like Klimt and other artists that just do an sort of mannerist painting that combines these sort of like more highly decorative graphic elements with sort of really careful rendering.
Yeah. So anyway, he did a tweet that just said, my next video is about that painting that you hate. And this was posted kind of jokingly to the Cube Talk Discord, which of course turned into a huge argument about art because everyone fell for the bait. The tweet was clearly bait. It just said, you hate this thing, right? And everyone was just like, we're going to fight about it. So that kind of inspired this conversation. And I want to start with this particular piece, but really it's more about... I have some thoughts about AI art, and this is my platform. I don't have a blog. I don't write anywhere else, so this is where I'm going to talk about things I'm thinking about.
I mean, should we talk a little bit about just, like, why there is art in magic at all?
Yeah, I think we should start at square one, for sure.
Okay, great. Why is there art in magic, Andy?
Well, I was going to say that I think I want to start with, like, the most cynical possible view, and let's work backwards from there.
Oh, okay. I mean, I feel like the baseline, the most, I wouldn't call it cynical, but most utilitarian view is just like, the art in magic is doing a couple things at once. It's creating a bit of a narrative. It's creating sort of an immersive space to tell you a story. And it does a really like important job there. Some people might be in sort of the Ben Stark mindset that the pictures don't matter. You know, the cards could just have the numbers and what they do. And you could just be reading these like totally mechanical things with no aesthetic quality at all. And the game would still be the same. I don't think basically anybody is really in that camp. Like, maybe literally Ben Stark is, but I'd
even
be shocked
him,
if even
I think he wants to be.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's really true. So, I mean, it does just pull you into the game a little bit more into a space. But I think more pragmatically, it then just acts as like a memory aid. It's so much easier to recognize a card sitting across the table when you've seen the illustration before. And, I mean, if you've ever tried playing with like playtest cards, or even just like if somebody prints out black and white versions of cards to playtest, it is so much harder to tell what's going on. Even just, you know, the shapes of the words and the shapes of the text in the text box, all that goes to just making the game much easier to play because you have this memory of just like how the card looks. And I think all of that also kind of merges together where the narrative element and the fiction that it builds feeds into just like the memory aids and it being an easier to understand game, because you see a creature with wings on it and you immediately think, oh, this probably has flying, so you can't block it. Or here is a picture of something exploding, so this is going to be a removal spell. Or here's just like a whole bunch of creatures, so maybe this makes tokens. And I think it's really easy to take for granted how important that is just to like making the game legible and readable and understandable.
It's a part of the game design.
But it is huge, and you really feel it if you ever encounter a card that just doesn't look like what it is.
Fearless Fledging does not always
Mystic,
fly.
Or you see Mystic Remora, and you're like, well, clearly this is a creature, and it maybe has Defender because it's a fish, and it's like, no, this is just an enchantment. They work really hard to make sure that those inconsistencies or incongruities don't happen that often, but when they do, you really feel it as just like a person trying to not have a bunch of extra mental baggage while you're playing the game.
Yeah. But let's start more cynical, Anthony.
Okay, fine.
I think the most cynical take is that effectively there isn't actually any art in Magic the Gathering. The drawings and illustrations used in Magic the Gathering barely even constitute art. Like, they are to art, to visual art, what like cinematography is to like Super Bowl commercials, right? They exist to market the game. They are not designed to elicit strong emotion or to like express anyone's individual thoughts or feelings. There's very, very rigid constraints on what they can and cannot be, both ideologically and stylistically. It's all work for hire for like very specific contracts. Like, is a lot of arguments that like we went to art school. In art school, we would not discuss any of this as art with a capital A.
Okay, well, maybe I was in a different department than you, which I was, because that is absolutely not the case. The conversation of our game's art was a daily conversation, and the answer was generally, yes, of course they are.
Sure, the game design aspects of it, and certainly, like, there was an illustration department. This is illustration. Illustration is, like, a very small subset of the vast world of fine art. It's even a small subset of the vast world of just visual art, right? We're not even getting into performance and all that kind of stuff. And within that space, it's, like, a very commercialized art form, right? Like, the illustration and graphic design departments were like notoriously the two departments at our school where you could like get a job after you after you graduated. That was like kind of their whole shtick. So that's the most cynical take. I don't agree with that take, but I think it's worth laying the groundwork and just saying that like the art is in Magic because it's an important marketing tool, it's an important game design tool, and it is somewhere between decoration and a Super Bowl commercial and fine art. And I think it's important to like understand that that's a spectrum when talking about Magic art.
Sure. So, I mean, is your point kind of that the goal is not communication or trying to express something or create a particular kind of emotion? It is to sell a product. That is the only reason it is there.
Yeah.
Such that basically they could just do A-B testing and figure out what's going to sell the best, and you could actually take out all the human element entirely and just arrive at this sort of what is functional at selling the most widgets. That's kind of what you're saying in this cynical take.
I mean, you took it to the extreme a little bit.
I'm trying to.
But I think there's a lot of people that would argue that in the age of AI, and Wizards explicitly said they will not do this, right? But, like, Caleb Gannon kind of did this, and I want to, like, couch that in a lot of kind of, because Caleb was very instrumental in actually writing the code that was generating the images.
Right.
He wasn't just, like, going on to Midjourney or whatever and typing in, like, you know, the name of his card and then, like, copying and pasting it. But that was an example of a card game that uses generative art. And I think we're going to see a lot of these things in the future. Like, I imagine Kickstarters in the future when you have no budget and you want to make a game.
You called it art.
I told you, it's not my take. But there is a big difference between an artist trying to make work to mean something and being one small piece of this giant corporate publicly traded conglomerate that essentially is Magic. So anyway, I think we're going to see a lot more like generated art. And I think you definitely could argue that in some sense, you could make a very similar end product by using AI to generate images and A/B test those images and have humans, you know, review them and say which one they like more or, you know, test them somehow to figure out which ones are going to perform best. And yeah, I think that's one end of the spectrum of like what Magic art actually is.
So I think about this a lot, and I'm pretty intentional about the way that I talk about the quote-unquote art in Magic, because I tend to just not call it art at all. I just call it illustrations. The illustrations in the card.
That's what they are.
Because that is, I think, just a better description of what we're actually looking at. Because it's not that I want to minimize the creative value of the people that are creating these illustrations. I just think it is a better description. And a big part of that, there's sort of two big components to it. One is that I also really don't want to minimize what I think is a much bigger piece of art, which is the game as a whole. I think absolutely the game is a work of art.
And the people making the most important creative decisions, I would argue, are like the creative team that do the story building, the world building.
Right.
Like, that has a bigger impact in a lot of ways than the actual craftsperson, the technician who is creating the illustration for an individual card, right? They're given so much.
Right.
They're given a full style guide for the entire world. That's actually where a lot of the creativity, again, in big air quotes, happens. Not to say that drawing a picture is not creative. Obviously, it is. But there are a ton of constraints that the illustrators are working within.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other sort of component of it is, if you're in this sort of corporate world of production of stuff, it's called like the art department or the creative department. And I think that that's really minimizing when in this sort of capitalist system, we just minimize it as like, oh yeah, we have to finish out the details and put a pretty picture on it. That's what quote unquote art is. And I don't love that. I'm not delighted to be part of that system where we sort of sideline art to this fleshing out of the details. But obviously that is very much what it is. So I just feel like art as a term gets pretty hairy, so just calling them the illustrations is more descriptive. And I think that you're right. A lot of it is sort of just this technical process of, we need to fill in the details. You know, we are trying to create art and give players an emotional experience of, I am sitting down to draft and I open up this cool dragon, and it's exciting because the power and toughness are way bigger than any number I've seen before on a dragon, and it's got
flame coming
out of its mouth, and it looks cool and exciting. That is all part of this creative expression and this experience that the game designers are trying to create, and that illustration is one component that sort of, yeah, rounds out the details and finishes that experience. So I think you're right that in some ways a lot of these illustrations are much more comparable to like thinking about animators doing tweening, where they have to take the style guide, take the art sort of the description, and kind of flesh out those details. And it's not necessarily that the artist is driven primarily by some sort of creative expression.
Yeah. And, you know, the Ristic Studies video, again, has not yet come out. Maybe this conversation will look ridiculous in the wake of the video if, you know, Sam breaks the internet again with one of his great videos and it has a lot of interesting points. But I think Sam's channel does a really good job of taking the art, the illustrations in Magic, very, very seriously and trying to investigate them with the same kind of rigor that somebody would investigate fine art, that we would have talked about studying art, you know, in art school. And I love Sam's videos, but I think a lot of that ends up falling kind of flat to me because a lot of what we're saying right now goes unmentioned. It's just like, okay, yeah, you are diving into all these details of this thing and this person's references and influences, and that's all cool and good, but the like core reason for this thing existing, which I think is one of the most important questions of any piece of art, the answer is totally different than you would ever find in any art gallery or any art history book of ever. Basically, I mean, you can go back to like the arts and crafts movement and like the earliest roots of what would eventually become graphic design. And that was like some of the first commercial art that we can like actually tie to commerce, right? Someone was paid to decorate a thing, basically. And a couple hundred years after that, we find ourselves, you know, looking at these elaborately illustrated Magic cards. But
yeah, I mean, I feel like you are, just to caveat that, talking about sort of a very specific kind of process and relationship between what does commerce mean and production of creative stuff mean in the context of commerce, because obviously people have been paying money for art for thousands of years, you know.
Kind of. It was like rich people commissioning things.
Right, which is
and
very
the church
different.
Commissioning
That's
things.
That's very different yeah. from somebody producing something for mass market.
Yes, for sure.
I mean, I think it's worth sort of mentioning where the sort of description of the process of creating illustrations for Magic cards isn't actually accurate. You know, it's accurate for a lot of the commons that fill out a set where it's just like, yep, we need a spider shooting web at elf flying on flying thing, flying bird. And so it's like, it's pretty constrained, like you said, and there's not a lot of wiggle room. But I think that there are a lot of areas where this actually doesn't pan out, and there is a lot of the artist's intention that comes through. The biggest that comes to mind is obviously just like, art from the very early days of Magic was much broader, much more flexible, and I feel like individual artists just had a lot more creative expression.
I mean, a lot of the art wasn't even made for Magic. It was just, like, bought, basically. The rights were bought at, you know, like, a flea market, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and you look back, some of these, like, to me, the ones that really stand out are, like, the Kev Walker, really gritty Phyrexians are just really, really appealing to me. Or the RK Post, just, like, really dynamic, intense colors and textures. Like, clearly these artists had a lot of self-expression that was coming through in these. And then I think sort of on the totally opposite end, after sort of moving through this period of kind of refinement and making the whole of Magic a much more polished, complete product and cohesive product, more recently in the last 3-4 years, Wizards has really been expanding and giving back in a more intentional way that creative control to the illustrators that they work with. And I think that this Faithless Looting illustration is a perfect example where they just kind of let Carly do her thing and do the kind of work
presumably
that she really shines at. And if you look at the rest of her work, it feels so much more, it's so much easier to understand this when you look at it in the context of a bunch of her other works.
Are you suggesting that context matters?
Yes, but what I mean is not that context matters. It means that the way you will look at... Yes, I mean context matters.
Got him.
Damn. So yeah, I mean, I think that it's been interesting where on one hand, I'm really kind of turned off by the way that Wizards has changed the way that they've produced the game and produced, you know, reams and reams of different variations of cards, largely because they just want to have more versions to sell to collectors. But also part of that is carving out more space to let artists do more creative things. So this is the challenge of living in the society that we do, is there's not clean-cut answers, and there are aspects of the changes in the way that Magic is produced that are both positive and some that are really, really negative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe a little more charitable than you need to be, because the constructs...
That's what you're here for.
the constructs under which Wizards is working are entirely their invention. Like, you're saying, like, oh, well, this allows them to be more creative. They could just let the artist be more creative in the regular game, but they won't because of the capitalist motivations to make a consistent, glossy product that has a higher risk of not offending people than it does of being truly powerful.
Right, that's true. I mean, I think... Even if they were pretty deliberate about it, it would be difficult to thread the needle in a way that it felt compelling. Like, the fact that the very early Magic illustrations were kind of rough and had a lot more personality worked when the game was literally a lot smaller, didn't necessarily have the same production, didn't necessarily have the same context and player expectations. I don't think you can necessarily just keep doing that. Like, I think that that increase in cohesiveness and polish is kind of inevitable.
In a sense, I agree. I think it is inevitable because it will happen. I don't think it's inevitable because it would be impossible not to, right?
It's inevitable because it will happen. Yes, that's exactly what I mean by inevitable.
It's a weird distinction I'm trying to draw. It's like, yes, the way our world functions, things will naturally trend and move that way, and you would have to like resist that trend with every ounce of your like energy in order to keep that from happening, right? Like, as the game grew and they hired their first art directors, creative directors, world builders that were like doing all the work behind the scenes to make the stuff consistent, all of those people have these baked in expectations of what that means, what consistent means, and like to try and resist all of that and like say, no, we're going to actively embrace a like broader, more varied style and like let artists express themselves more or whatever would just be very difficult to do. So I want to express that I agree that it was going to happen, but I don't think that it absolves people of their role in that process, right? Like, it was going to happen, but still these people chose to do it. Like, we should still recognize that Wizards made the choice, even if they were always going to make that choice in every reality.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. I mean, I feel this way a lot about sort of the general direction of technology, where people who are in control and have a lot of power are constantly telling us, you know, this is inevitable. Embrace AI because it's inevitable. It will happen, so you might as well, A, get used to it, or, like, it might as well be us, the good guys, who are in control of it. And I increasingly just feel like my response is, like, absolutely not. Stop telling me this is inevitable. If we don't want to do this, we cannot do it. Apply that to whatever thing is happening.
Yes, but it is inevitable under our current system of
motivations. It's like, I get this is happening, but don't tell it to me with a smile. Like, acknowledge
it. Don't tell
me
you're the good guy, because you never are.
Yeah.
Someone saying they're the good guy loudly, never the good guy, turns out.
I feel like I just need to name more Magic cards so I get to put them on the cards mentioned page. Robert Bliss was just like one of my absolute favorite artists from the early days. Just these like weird, lumpy, often kind of horny pictures, but I just... apparently, I actually have to name some cards. I mean, like...
You haven't named any cards yet, so... I'm editing, and I've got my keyboard on my notepad to write down the cards
right,
you mentioned.
We got Ekundu Cyclops. Like, look at this weird guy just...
Oh yeah, I can picture
jumping
that
over the two moons and keening Banshee. I know you're gonna say like the big just centered circle with a thing in front of it is not your favorite composition, but it
what?
Works for me.
What did I say was my favorite composition?
We've had words about this card or Goblin Soothsayer.
No, I like that card. What words have we had about
okay,
keening Banshee?
Excellent. Maybe we've more talked about Changeling. Is it Changeling Hero?
I hate all the Changelings because they
look
stupid.
They look great. I love them. And unfortunately, they couldn't keep working with Robert Bliss because he kept trying to make images that were a little bit too graphic. But, I mean, that's just so much personality, and I just love all of these illustrations.
Yeah, I think you're touching on an important thing, which you kind of referenced earlier, which is that as the game has grown, it's become a multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar business over time. Obviously, the inertia of a like big organization is willing to take many fewer risks, right? I'm sure there are many artists they cut ties with because they weren't willing or able to produce work that was in line with the expectations they had for what they wanted Magic art to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say it, maybe this, you know, makes me, old fogey or whatever, but I do think that the early Magic art in all of its eccentricities is a lot more evocative than the current Magic art, which the vast, vast, vast majority of is like digitally painted fantasy stuff that is like the upper crust of what you could have found on DeviantArt in 2001.
Sure, that's a sick burn.
I mean, a lot of these artists were on DeviantArt.
Yeah,
and like,
we were all on DeviantArt.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the very cynical take earlier of like there is no art in Magic, and I think that's a very extreme take, but I think a ton of the art, you know, by quantity, the individual commissions, like I think a ton of it is completely devoid of any kind of artist's touch, an artist's hand that is of any substance. It is just filling in those rectangles on the cards for the most part.
Sure. And do you say that with sort of a lack of judgment? Like, the illustrator's doing a job and they're doing a good
absolutely.
Job.
Absolutely. Like, do a job and get paid. Like, you know, cash that check, whatever. And I think if you were to talk to a lot of these illustrators and ask them, like, is this your life's work? Is this the art you're most proud of? Is this the, you know, the work that is this what you set out to do when you became an artist? I think a lot of them would tell you, like, no, this is how I pay the bills. This is, like, the world we live in, right? I mean, I am a graphic designer by trade.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to point the finger at you, do you feel like what you do every day is art? Is this,
absolutely
is this
not.
The work
no.
that you wanted to do when you went to art school?
Absolutely not. For sure not. I mean, it's part of getting older and like living in a society where you have to pay a mortgage and, you know, pay your own medical bills all the time because we don't have nationalized healthcare in this stupid country. No, I don't. And honestly, I think that road when you study graphic design is much shorter. Like, you study the history of graphic design, and it's just, oh, this is the history of corporate America. Like, graphic design doesn't have a history. It's just the history of companies realizing that they could pay artists to do very specific types of marketing for them. And honestly, way more than marketing. Like, the idea of branding, of, like, turning companies into these entities with personalities is this, like, brilliant trick that the corporate world has played on us, and their tools were graphic designers. They were artists that basically just allowed themselves to become the hands of these organizations in order to like fulfill some anthropomorphized corporate vision for turning these companies into like entities with personality.
I thought you said we were starting with the cynical take and it was going to get less cynical.
If you want to get, I mean, I can't talk about graphic design without being incredibly cynical. And honestly, the reason is because I'm like burned by it. Like, I love the exercise of quote unquote branding, which is to say, I think it is really fascinating to take an idea and try and build a concise visual language that represents that idea. You just only get to do that when the idea is a company selling to people. That's the only context you're allowed to do that work in. That work doesn't exist in any other context. But if that was a thing you could do for people or for other kinds of ideas that weren't just, and there's some of this, right? If you like look at political campaigns, right? And we put a little bit of cynicism aside about what politics is, right? But theoretically, there's some of this that goes on outside of the corporate world, but not much. That's what graphic design is. And I will never suggest that graphic design is art. It's creative work, but it is not art in any sense, in my personal opinion.
Yeah.
I don't want to get pedantic about the definition of art, but I do want to talk about how they're, like, whatever you want to call art and, like, label as art, these are very different sets of things, right? Everything from the logo on a Starbucks cup to the illustration on a Magic card to a performance piece by Marina Abramović. Like, there's a spectrum here, and we can't put these things into, like, clean buckets. And if you're talking about Magic art and you're not acknowledging the broad capitalist construct under which it's all created, then you're missing a huge part of the picture.
So we hit context matters. We said everything's a spectrum. What other
is that one now? Do I have to add the bell after the word spectrum as well?
I think so. I think we've done that enough.
Okay, fine. More bells, more bells. So anyway, to come back to this illustration of Favus Looting, I don't like it as a Magic card. I think it is out of place and anomalous enough in the context of other Magic cards to look like a mistake. And I think that's what a lot of people have responded to. Like, it feels like it doesn't belong. Even like all the other Strixhaven Mystical Archive cards, the vast majority of them have a pretty clear art direction, and it's like an Art Nouveau, Art Deco, very highly ornate graphic style. And this one's just totally different. There's a couple other outliers. But for the most part, like, there's a pretty consistent style to the Mystical Archive cards, and this one's just very different. So I think, looking at it from the capitalist perspective of Wizards of the Coast, the art directors, the creative directors. I think this one's a miss, a swing and a miss, frankly. And for that reason, I don't like it as a product, as a illustration to fill the prompt to illustrate this card. I think the reason why this card is so divisive is that some people are looking at it in that light. They're looking at it in the light of other Magic cards. They're like, what the heck is this? It doesn't make sense to me. I don't get it. It doesn't look like any of the Magic card I've ever seen. It doesn't match the other cards in this frame. It just feels wrong, right? And those are the people for whom this is not art. This is a small component of this broader game that they care about. The broader game is the art. And in this case, I think the small component is failing. Then there are people that really like it. And if I had to place my bets, I would guess that Sam of Rissic Studies is going to make a whole video arguing about why you should like this card. And it's basically going to boil down to, it represents all of those things about old Magic cards that we kind of liked. It represents Wizards being willing to take a risk, being willing to print a card that some people are going to get confused and mad about. And it offers this like glimmer of hope that the art in Magic is not just purely commercial marketing, but there is actually some artist's voice left in there. Like, Carly's hand is more present in this piece than almost any other Magic art I can remember in recent memory, right? There are some artists with pretty clearly defined styles, your Seb McKinnons, your Rebecca Guays, but for the most part, this is like the most, the piece I think speaks most to who this artist is of any Magic art I can remember in recent history. And I think people that are excited about that are imagining a world where that's something that Wizards continues to value and not this one weird fluke that kind of snuck by.
Yeah, I think I agree with all that. At the same time, then it's just, I'm sort of just like hit by this miasma of, well, I appreciate Magic for what it is. Maybe it doesn't also need to be what old school Magic was at the same time.
For sure.
You know, maybe I can just have my little stack. I literally have a small stack of cards that are in my collection just because I think they're beautiful illustrations. I've just got my, you know, 10th edition Terror with the cycle of
That one's messed up.
Different flayed people. Just because I like to take it out and look at it every once in a while. And the fact that Magic has, yeah, so I mean, I was saying how I don't really know how to feel about them trying to sort of, there's sort of this good and bad about them expanding the scope of Magic illustration today, but maybe I'm more just feeling like I don't need that to happen, and I can just go get that creative expression from other hobbies and other activities.
Well, here's what I was going to ask you. Would you ever put a framed piece of Magic art on your wall?
I have a particular aesthetic. And my one, like, nod to this aspect of my nerdy interest that I have
is
house is a big bowl of dice, which I think is cool. It's kind of like D&D meets Pier 1 kind of vibe.
So no.
It would be... I do also have a couple other Magic-related things on my wall. I have a screen-printed poster from somebody that used to print posters when we first started playing Magic for
the
Magic
dance party. In a style that would never be on
a Magic.
Well, I guess now it would be.
Now
on
it would be, absolutely.
Kind of some Magic cards, I guess.
The cube map from last CubeCon is on my wall.
None of these are illustrations
for
Magic cards.
None of them are illustrations for Magic card. I don't think so, because it's not just... It's not... Like, these are designed with a particular style that makes sense in a card which doesn't necessarily fit on a wall.
Right. Yeah.
Even the ones that I really appreciate, they are, I mean, I think
they're
a lot
part
of the illustrators,
of this broader context.
They do a good job of making an illustration that works on a card.
Yeah. Yeah, I would never put an illustration from Magic on my wall either. Not because it's an illustration from Magic per se, just because, I guess actually, small caveat, the art I use for my Bun Magic Cube on Cube Cobra is the Circle of Protection artist promo that Mark Tadeen did. And that one is, like, so goofy and almost ironic, and, like, it's very much, it's from the era of Magic, right? Like, it references a bunch of early cards in this, like, very weird kind of campy way, and was also produced and painted a long time ago. It's a physical painting, and I would maybe, if I could get a hold of that original, which I would never be able to, obviously, I would maybe hang that one up because it's so self-referential. Like, it knows what it is, and it's like making fun of that a little bit, which I think is okay. But otherwise, I can't imagine putting a Magic illustration on my wall because, yeah, it's just like to me that like makes you a sucker. It's like
wow.
It's like I've always kind of felt this way about movie posters, to be honest, and you can be critical of this other poster sitting, like, this poster on my wall is literally an advertisement, right? And it's a little bit of a sucker to put an advertisement on your wall. It's like, you just fell for it, right? It's like saying
I got you a movie poster years ago that I've been waiting for you to hang up.
Yeah, and it will never go anywhere because it's awful. The poster in question, for those that want to look into it, is a it's giant. It's more than...
It's huge.
I think it's a 3-foot poster, 3-foot tall.
And in my memory, it's only grown over the years.
It's really big, and it's a poster from the movie The Room, the one poster, which is just Tommy Wiseau's face at hyper close-up macro shot. And no, it's never going on my wall. It was bought as a gag gift, and it remains in my gag folder. Anyway, I think it makes you a sucker for putting this art that... Man, people are going to get so mad at me.
Yeah,
for that.
People Look, are going to get mad at you.
No offense. If you get something different out of this than me, great. If I were to put that on my wall, I would feel like a sucker because it is this marketing piece that was made under very cynical conditions, right? It was made for pay with very strict rules to satisfy the constraints of a particular art director, creative director, a certain plane, a certain story they're trying to tell. I agree. It's a really valuable piece of an overall creative product, which I really like, which is the game of magic, which is a individual set of magic that has been designed to tell a story and to be interactive and have all these elements that work together in a beautiful symphony. As soon as you like take it out of that context and try to value it on its own as if it were standalone fine art, I think the whole facade just falls apart.
I get what you're coming from. I definitely don't feel as extreme as you do in that I think a lot of people who are passionate about many things enjoy sort of collecting the artifacts and minutia of it. Like, big docs myself, but, you know, my dad's a stamp collector, and the stamps are not really for me, but that's fine, whatever. But in addition to the stamps, he also has, like, oh, here's a, you know, sheet of just the paper they used to print on, and you can see the watermark in more detail because it doesn't have a printing on it, or here's, you know, a envelopes, and so you see the stamps in context, and sort of having these things that are no longer in their natural context. It's not, you know, on a stamp going through the postal system, but you still have these things that represent the way that that broader sort of system and object was made.
But that's
and so I appreciate people valuing the actual act of taking it out of context illuminates something about the way that the bigger structure was created.
Yeah, but that to me is so much more beautiful because those were not things that were made to market some product, right?
They were sort of made to market the product of colonialism and empire.
Look at
this guy's profile. Don't you love that strong chin and feel comfortable with him ruling your island nation?
I mean, it's a very important it's a very important artifact of history that is much more meaningful than the artifact of the history of the creative department at Wizards of the Coast that hired this illustrator to do a digital painting of whatever, right? Like, the story is embedded in these objects. The story of those stamps, while still full of the monsters of history, is interesting and valuable. The story of the capitalist motivations behind the game is not. It's just a bummer.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there.
Anyway, all this is to say that when I look at this piece of Carly's for Favis Looting, which, again, I said is not to my taste, right? I don't love it aesthetically. Maybe if I looked at the rest of Carly's work, I would feel differently, but...
Hi there, Andy here. Please forgive my poor audio quality. I am traveling and editing this podcast on the road, so I don't have access to my precious studio. I just wanted to pop in here and say that I did look at the rest of Carly's portfolio while editing this show, and I do like it a lot. I think it's a lot of beautiful work that really is to my taste, and honestly, my least favorite piece, kind of by a wide margin, is the piece for Favis Looting, which I would argue probably has to do with the context under which it was created, but maybe I'm just projecting. You decide. Anyway, her site is linked in the show notes. Make sure you check it out. I think it is well worth your time.
My biggest feeling is that I didn't think about it for very long. I saw it on a magic card and was like, that doesn't really fit. I guess, usually I'm always glad to just like give accolades to Wizards of the Coast for taking any risks because it is so hard to take risks when you're a big company. So I guess, you know, there's your half a kudos for just like doing a thing that might have made some people mad. But for the most part, I don't really think about it. What it does put me in mind of is something I've been thinking about more lately as these mid journeys of the world have gotten more accessible and better at like rendering images, which is that I feel like we are on the precipice of a new moment in specifically visual art in history, right? And I think we've actually talked about Impressionism on the show before. I can't remember what episode. We had one episode where we talked about going to art school. Was it that episode? We talked about critique in that episode, though. I feel like it must have come up at some point because I feel like I have a memory of talking with you about it on air. But for those that don't know, this is like, to me, one of the most powerful things you learn about art history when you study art history, which is that for the vast majority of human history, visual artists, painters, or whatever, were largely just trying to paint the real world as accurately as they could. Or they were trying to paint, you know, depictions of fictional or historical events that were, you know, referencing the real world so it looked like it was real or whatever. But for the most part, they were just like trying to paint things that looked real. That was like the challenge, and you were held up as a good artist if you could do that, and a poor artist if you couldn't, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot more... There's more nuance to that we're going to cover in a few minutes on a podcast about Magic the Gathering. But
yes.
But yeah, I mean, I think that the one important detail to that is that looking real could mean many different things depending on your perspective.
Right,
so
they weren't all trompe-l'oeil paintings. Yeah.
The Western sort of highly rendered realistic type of perspective on the world was very different than, say, the many Eastern traditions where you didn't have the same sense of perspective even, because it's like, well, it is not real that these things are different sizes, so why do we change sizes depending on where they are in the composition? Both of those things are factual in a way of describing the world through imagery.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, this point I'm making is really pretty much entirely about the Western art movement. Like, Eastern art is a whole different thing that actually I'm just much less educated about. But so for the most part, you have people through time trying to paint things that looked real. And then along comes photography. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, if I want, like, if my idea of what painting is a means by which to produce an end product, right? If the end product is something that looks real, then now I have a new tool to do this way better. I can just take a picture instead. And now I don't need painters to do this work anymore because I have photography. And there genuinely were people at the time that were like, well, painting's over now, everybody. Pack it all up. We have photography. Why would you ever have to paint ever again? For a little while, they were like, well, wait till we invent color photography. Then painting's all over. Which, you can see how that would happen, right? You can see how, if that was in fact your charge, you would just be defeated by a lens, you know, capturing some photons on a piece of film and then developing it and printing it. But what this actually did was kind of light the fire under the modern art movement, right? And again, we're broadly simplifying here, but I think the broad story is very compelling and worth touching on, which is that photography comes along painting realistically for only the goal of painting realistically, right? Like, I mean, a lot of artists, like, literally were just employed in painting rich people, like just portraits of rich people and their horses and dogs, because that's who would pay them, right? The same way the illustrators now are employed drawing pictures of dragons and, you know, whatever. It was, at the time, it was just portraits of rich people. So if rich people just wanted portraits of themselves, now they had cameras. And so a lot of artists were ostensibly out of work in that way. But what it actually did was allow artists to do something totally different, right? Now they no longer had this, like, flag set in the distance of, as soon as we can paint as realistically as possible, like, that's the point. That's what we're all aiming for. Now they're free to do whatever they want, and we get Impressionism, right? And Impressionism, for those of you who have not studied art or don't know the term, this basically refers to the paintings at the, like, end of the 1800s, early 1900s, that were the beginnings of the idea of abstraction formally in painting.
Starry Night and Water Lilies.
Yeah, you know, Manet, Monet, all these artists, like, just were all of a sudden willing to say, yeah, I know that this is not exactly what it looks like, but I'm going to paint it a little differently, right? And that's where the name comes from. Right? You're not painting the thing, you're painting your impression of the thing. That's, like, where Impressionism comes from, basically. And this has a lot of ways it manifests itself, right? Like, you're capturing things that a camera lens couldn't capture. You're capturing, like, your own particular point of view on a moment. Like, you're excluding things from the scene that you feel are not important. Obviously, a camera lens is not going to exclude anything. It's going to have the same detail across every single square inch of the surface. You as an artist don't have to do that. And the other thing that was a big part of this was, again, very broad strokes here, but for a lot of the history of painting, the goal was for your painting to, the actual paint itself, to become invisible, right? Like, you didn't want to see brush strokes, you didn't want to see evidence of the tool used to make the piece. The idea was to make this perfect rendering and have your tools and your hand fall away and just become invisible. And with Impressionism, they really embraced the idea of being able to see brushstrokes, actually use the medium as a physical thing that was part of the piece rather than being this invisible way that an image is rendered. And then Impressionism leads to, like, everything else we recognize today as modern art, right? All of the giant sculptures, all of the, like, really theoretical and, like, highly experimental art you can imagine. It leads to Marina Abramović, right? And I don't know if we ever get any of that if we don't get the camera invented, right? I mean, it's impossible to imagine such a radically different parallel reality, but If we never get the camera, are we still just trying to paint things as accurately as possible, paint and draw things that they look as real as possible, and do we get none of this exploration? I don't know, but it's really interesting that that is like really the beginning of modern art, right? Is Impressionism and the invention of the camera in a lot of ways. Again, very broad strokes here, but that story I think is very compelling in terms of understanding how we got to Jackson Pollock just like splattering paint on a canvas and calling it art, something that a lot of people just look at and say like, well, you just splattered paint on the canvas. My kid could do that. I don't get it. And what it actually is something that grew very naturally out of this like transition from trying to paint things realistically. Ooh, what if we got a little more loose with it? We could see some brushstrokes. We like were more impressionistic about it. And then you just like follow that to its logical conclusion and you get the action painters. You get the really extreme abstraction. I actually think there's a really interesting case study for this, which is P.A. Mondrian, who people, if you know the name, you will know this artist for basically like asymmetrical grids of black lines with bold geometric shapes, usually just in like primary colors that are making up the whole canvas. Like
stained glass, but just rectangles.
Yeah. And I bet if you Google P.A. Mondrian, you'll see a thing you maybe recognize as like a famous piece of modern art or whatever. This particular artist, like over the course of his entire life, basically you can look at a body of his work. Like I've looked at a book of his work from the beginning, and he started out painting pretty realistically and then just got more and more and more abstract until he was literally doing just giant rectangles. Like it was like a linear.
It's like, here's a tree. Now yeah. Here's a tree, but all the branches look a little squarier, and now it looks a little squarier, and he keeps painting slightly different trees, and eventually there's not really a tree anymore.
It's been ages since I looked at this book, and I'm not an expert on this particular artist's career, so I don't want to like, I might get some of these details wrong, but as I remember, it was like over the course of his career, a pretty linear progression. Like, at no point did he say, what if I jump a couple notches down the line and just like, you know, see where this is logically going. He just kind of followed this path. And that's kind of the path that a lot of the painting world followed because of the camera. You and I are both very skeptical about all of the big promises that tech utopians are making about what AI can or will do. Is that safe to say? Very cynical, very skeptical.
Cynical, skeptical, overwhelmed, defeated. I don't feel good about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, at least for me, there's some part of me that's like excited and interested in technology, and that part of me is completely drowned out by the part of me that is just so lamenting the fact that we don't have a world that we could introduce this technology into that will allow it to do cool stuff, because the only thing it's going to do is just make more garbage, because that's what is in demand, and that's what it's really good at. So I sound very cynical and skeptical when I talk about it. That's not to say there's not a part of me that doesn't think it's so cool, right? I've played with some of these things, and they're really cool for what they are. But what they are not are these like magical mirrors that are going to replace every single artist in the world and let everybody be as creative as they want to be, any more than the invention of the camera made everybody a fantastic painter, right? Like, photography became its own art in some sense, and I would not be totally surprised to find that like people learning how to interact with large language models and image generators and things like that. I mean, honestly, like technicians like that, like Caleb on his game Algomancy, like that's kind of like the photographer, but for machine learning and, you know, generative art in some sense. But I do think it's very cool. And if I'm honest, I do think that, for example, a lot of the art in Magic the Gathering could theoretically be replaced by AI, and a lot of people wouldn't notice. I think a lot of the art is uninspired and could actually just be generated because it does have a very consistent style. It's very glossy. It's very refined. It's like not taking any risks. And yeah, right now if you do it, like some of the fingers are all wrong, and if you like zoom in, there's like weird little artifacts and stuff, but it's rendered on a tiny little card, and it's not hard to imagine that part of the technology getting better, so they get the things like the finger count and whatever right? Like, I'm not so cynical that I think that those problems are insoluble and they will always be there, and that is kind of scary to some people, I think.
Yeah. I mean, so, okay, if we go back to the most cynical take, I'm just looking at the most recent set, and I'm pulling up Crime Novelist just as an example. We got a picture of a little goblin. He's writing a novel, so he's got documents and an inkwell and some other bits and bobs around the desk. And it's like, if we take that cynical perspective of there was a lot of art direction, a lot of card design that went into this, and then we needed some illustrator to come in and fill the details and make this feel polished and cohesive and look like this is a little window into a world where a goblin is writing a novel.
Right.
There isn't necessarily the artistry there that requires the human intervention to decide on the details, you know, whether there's a skull or a beaker or a feather plume or a hat in the corner. It doesn't really matter. So, sure, if the details don't matter, we can use this auto-plagiarism machine to just fill it in, which is not even a new thing. Like, the fact that somebody could just go take a skull or take a feather hat and cut and paste that from another image, that's already something you can do, large language or large image models. Sorry, my language isn't up here.
They are actually still large language models because they have to parse your language and turn it into an image.
So these models are not necessarily even doing something unique. They're just doing the copying and pasting in this like incredibly more efficient and more complex, obviously, way. But yeah, I mean, if the details don't matter, then sure, that's fine. But we're just admitting that this is not about human expression. The details don't matter.
Did you follow that mini scandal with that marketing image? It wasn't card art, but it was a marketing image thing that Wizards put out.
I've heard about it a little bit.
Okay, so I'm going to fill you in on the details and get your opinions on it, because so what it was some marketing image for something, and there was like a big scene of a room with like a desk and a lantern, and I don't remember all the details of the actual piece itself, but somebody went on Twitter and did some like big thread and was like, this is evidence that Wizards is using AI. Look what I found in this thing. I found these artifacts here. These artifacts are clear evidence of use of AI. Do you know what actually caused those artifacts?
I thought they actually was AI generated.
Content aware fill.
Sure, which is the same thing.
Right. I mean, it's content aware fill, which is the thing that's been in Photoshop forever. Yeah. And
okay, so one quick clarification here. I hadn't planned to talk about this in the episode, so I didn't research it ahead of time. It just kind of came up. But it turns out that what I thought was content aware fill was actually a different tool called generative fill, which is a new tool that only came out in the past couple years and basically is just like having Midjourney or similar inside of Photoshop. And it seems that that was the tool that was used to generate this image. So more AI than I was under the impression of, but I think this bit of conversation is still relevant, so I'm keeping it in anyway. But wanted to make sure I got the facts right.
Again, like, we throw around these terms AI.
The buzzwords,
it's not intelligent. That's not what intelligence is.
This kind of technology is not brand new. It's had some big strides and has like much broader applications. Content aware fill worked in small parts of an image when there was more context it could pull from.
I mean, basically,
but it's
like
fundamentally not totally different.
No, that's the thing. Is like, I thought that was so instructive because everyone was like all up in arms that somebody used content aware fill. First of all, I guarantee that content aware fill has been used thousands of times on marketing images for Wizards of the Coast and every other company on the planet. But now people are like looking for, you know, a section where the same little tiny like bit of illustration was actually like cloned and used a little bit over here and semi-opaque or whatever. But for those that don't know, content aware fill in Adobe Photoshop is basically like you have a lot of Photoshop jobs that involve you essentially like Photoshopping someone out of something or Photoshopping a little detail out, a blemish
or
something.
Or there's like a watermark or text put over an image and you want to eliminate it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you probably shouldn't be removing watermarks from images. That's kind of...
Oh, but that's probably what it's used for 95% of the time.
So the way you would do this manually back in the day is you say, okay, let's say I have an apple with a blemish on it. This is my marketing photo for my fruit company. I don't want there to be a blemish on the apple. You would actually just go and like literally select little pieces of the apple skin around the blemish, and you would just kind of paste them over the blemish, and you'd like fudge it a little bit until it looked good. And in a lot of circumstances, you can make a very convincing Photoshop this way, and it looks like the blemish was never there. Content aware fill was just a technology they made to basically like speed up that process. You can just select an area and say, I want you to fill this with whatever's around it, right? Like, I have selected the area that I am describing to you is anomalous. I don't want this to be what it looks like. And it looks around that blemish you've selected and says, well, around me is all this green apple skin, so I guess I'll put green apple skin here. And there was definitely a moment when it first came out that people were like, whoa, mind blown, like huge wizardry. Because if you look at demos of it, it seems like it could be magical because the demos obviously are like the absolute perfect conditions.
They pick really good examples
for the demo?
The
absolute perfect conditions for it to work perfectly. But as someone who's used the tool a lot in my life, it's absolutely not magic. Sometimes it just works and you're very happy, but a lot of the times you just have to like, oh, I see you like thought that this person's face was what I wanted you to like copy and paste, but that's not the case. Anyway, all by means of saying, yes, that is like a very linear progression from someone using the stamp tool to using content aware fill to using Midjourney. Like, This is the same thing. It's on the same axis, just a different amount of input from the human and a different amount you're just giving up to the machine.
Yeah. I mean, that's all true. And I get that if the point is just to produce illustrations to get this cohesive product, it's not necessarily doing anything that is inherently evil. But me as a person that wants to engage with artworks, like I just have to be honest with myself or with the people that are producing these about what we're doing here. And the reality is, again, looking at Crime Novelist, there are a lot of details that do matter here. There's a little homunculus lurking in the corner, and, you know, maybe that's a skull of a particular creature that you find in this world. And those are things that only a human with some intention is going to pick up on and create, and that makes me invested in those details. And if those details are just totally arbitrary, then I'm not interested. I don't want to read synthesized content. I don't want to look at synthesized images in the way that I would look at a work of art and appreciate and engage in sort of a cultural conversation about what are we trying to express here. I will just look at it as, this is a marketing material, this is like, here is a memory aid, and it makes it easier to recognize which rectangles across the table, and that's as deep as I want to go.
I can't believe I'm playing devil's advocate here. Okay. But have you not walked around a space in Minecraft and marveled at the beauty of the landscape?
You are, I mean, this is really hitting me really, really hard, to be honest, because for more context, when I was in art school, a big thing that I was doing was algorithmic art,
yeah,
and designing algorithms that generated images, and a lot of the art that is on my walls at home is generative art that was, yeah, designed by other artists, and in a way, there is a superficial similarity to say, here is Midjourney, it is generative artwork, you give it a prompt and it gives you an image, value that if you want. Versus here's an algorithm someone has designed very intentionally to produce a certain type of image within some variation. And no, I don't think it's the same at all. I have a beautiful work of art by Robert Hodgen, which is a generative river. It's a river that doesn't exist, but he actually wrote an algorithm to simulate the way that rivers meander and over time trace how it branches off into oxbow lakes and creates different sedimentation patterns, and then wrote an algorithm to generate the way that farms might appear around it. And there's so much intention in the algorithm, even though there is a lot of variability, and from unique rendering to unique rendering that was created by this algorithm, there was still...
Because each one is unique, like your print is unique.
The series, yeah. So there's still like... I'm engaging with it in a way that I understand what is random about this image and what is spaced for me to think about what was the intention in this carefully designed algorithm that this artist has produced. And I see so much value in that. And I see the same thing in Minecraft. That's a much more accessible example, that somebody took the time to really carefully design these algorithms of how are we going to structure the biomes and make big biomes and small biomes, because that creates a more interesting world to explore. And how do we make the trees grow in a certain way that they fit in this generative space? So there is an algorithmicness to it, but there is still a ton of artistic expression, I think, in the way that that world is generated.
How do you put like Caleb's generative art for Algomancy?
Yeah,
on,
I mean,
this
that's
spectrum.
Perfect. It's definitely on that spectrum where,
because I agree, like just going into Midjourney and typing like "show me a hot dog blowing
up." I'm a prompt engineer now. I'm an artist. Look at this art I made by typing in "hot dog."
Yeah, I mean, like that is obviously one extreme example, and a lot of that stuff, like we said, it's a plagiarism engine. It's just like, yeah, you know, going to its references that have been.
Yeah,
largely...
let's just start calling it a plagiarism engine. I think that's so much more clear and is honest and accurate and useful.
But like, again, Wizards have said they won't go this way. I'm not advocating for them to go this way. I don't want them to. But I do think that it's possible to imagine a world where the same way that someone creates boundaries for their generative river or their generative artwork for their card game Algomancy or the worlds for Minecraft, the creative directors and art directors at Wizards of the Coast could work with engineers to design the boundaries of, yeah, the sort of visual language of a particular set. It would never be the same, right? Because in the same way that like a photograph never actually looks like a painting, right? Like it's always going to be a little bit,
yeah,
different.
There's something else that's really important about photographs that we should come back to.
Which is what?
Well, we'll come back to it. Finish your thought.
I don't remember my thought was. I was saying it would never be the same, right? Like, but I am not convinced you couldn't use very similar tools to arrive at a space where you would be interested in the details,
yeah,
and discovering how they had built this system that could possibly create this, you know, generative art. Obviously we're not there yet, and I'm obviously not talking about just like punching prompts into Midjourney and like calling it a day, but it's not hard for me to imagine that that would be a possible reality.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that's what makes this entire conversation much more difficult, is that there are reasonable applications to this technology, and of course, you know, we could even go like further afield and talk about like medical applications and like finding patterns in complex data. Like there are very real things this technology can do. And in the scope of artistic expression, Caleb's game is a perfect example where he really actually understands the technology, mm-hmm. so understands how to use it in a way to accomplish his creative goals, where he wants a certain aesthetic, he wants a certain type of imagery, and he's going to put in the effort to make it good, but it's still going to accelerate the amount that he can produce, where he can make, you know, hundreds of cards as a single person that you could never do if you were doing illustrations fully by hand. But Sturgeon's Law, 80% of everything is crap, or 95% right. of everything is crap. And this technology just allows you to produce so much crap so quickly. I think that we really need to update Sturgeon's Law.
Gotta bring Sturgeon back.
Like, say like 99.99% of everything is crap. And everything that this is going to produce is one Caleb Gannon's Algomancy and 99,000 spam emails and spam text messages.
Which...
And all this that's just being hammered into my face day in and day out, and like crappy films that just have no artistic inspiration and no creative.
But that's true
thing.
Of everything,
it
man.
Just,
like,
it just sucks.
Like, what percent of generative art prior to all of this stuff would you say you thought was good?
A lot
good?
Of it was pretty bad.
Ton of it is garbage. Like,
I mean,
like,
this is not different than
it's slightly less offensive garbage.
It's not that different from Apotheosis Flame Fractals of 2005 when everybody's like, I'm a fractal artist. Look, I hit random on.
Well, here's what's different about
times.
It. Here's what's different about it is that no one was
That's
looking
at... That's a call
at...
out that somebody is going to get.
What's different about it is no one back then was looking at that and saying, A, this is the future. B, this is as good or better than anything any artist can create. And C, I'm going to use this to make 1,000 spam emails, right? Like, it just... It wasn't popular enough to be abused by the... Yeah. systems of the structures and motivations that we have in 2024, which the Midjourneys, etc. of the world definitely are.
Yeah. And to be clear, I made some flame fractals, but I also
you didn't then put
remixing them and integrating them and doing collage, and I don't know, I feel like I did some okay arts.
Yeah, you did great art.
Thanks.
Anyway, all of this is by way of saying that I think, personally, all of the quote-unquote AI-generated images that I've seen, and I've seen quite a few... For the most part,
perhaps more than you know.
They have a quality to them which ties them together. And I'm not talking about people having two thumbs or, you know, these weird artifacts.
I have two thumbs.
There's a quality to them which, you know, you can also specify a style. Like, you know, give me this in the style of like a line drawing or whatever. So it's not they're the same style, but there's a quality to them which is like they're clearly trying to capture the mean, the lowest common denominator of, like, visual language, right? Like, if you tell it to generate a picture of a hot dog, I can't stop thinking about... Have you seen any of the jokes where people...
You showed me the increasingly hotter hot dogs.
Yeah, so good.
It's kind of funny.
I mean, yeah, that's not funny because the AI's genius. That's funny because of the way this person is interacting with the
sure.
thing. This, you know, it's not... It's no credit to the AI. That's a very funny meme. Anyway, when you say give me a picture of a hot dog, what you end up getting by default, unless you specify any other style, is like what looks like a really like
glossy
marketing
rendered,
picture.
Yeah.
Like it looks like a bad advertisement.
But also with shadows that don't make sense. And
yeah, there's all the details of, you know, stuff. Like, but it just has this quality of refinement, which actually, I think somewhat ironically, is for the most part attempting realism, right? Like that's the standard that everyone's holding these generators to right now, is like the same standard that we were holding painters to, is how realistic can you make this thing, how real can you make it look, right? And in the pursuit of that, I think what we are on the precipice of is a movement in visual art to do things that computers can't and won't do, to intentionally do the unexpected, make jarring, abrasive, incongruous things that will be valued much more highly because you will know when you look at it that a human being made it, that it was not made by a computer, because the nature of all of these huge data sets they have is that they hew towards like an average, right? And so if you start making things that are like wildly away from that average, I think it's very hard for computers to possibly mimic that. I mean, you actually kind of mentioned one of the things I want to touch on earlier, which is that in this illustration of Carly's, I keep calling her by her first name. We're not on a first name basis. I don't know how to pronounce your last name.
Because if you want to come on the podcast and talk about art, Carly, you're welcome.
But this illustration, like you said, has areas of extreme detail and areas of like just big sort of fields of color, right? That's a quality that you almost never see in AI-generated imagery, where you have like areas of extreme detail, extreme refinement, and then areas of like big, vast space, or like even just across the entire canvas, just different levels of finish, right? Like you just almost never get that. You get a very uniform finish across the entire canvas. And I'm sure somebody out there could like, you know, write some prompt that would start to get somewhere close to what I'm describing. But I actually, in spite of all of the doom and gloom and cynicism I have around AI and how stupid it is that every single blog post now for the rest of time is going to have some stupid AI-generated banner image, and every single YouTube video is going to have some stupid AI-generated thumbnail, right? That all sucks, and it's going to continue to suck. But in spite of that, I am no less confident in like the creativity of the human spirit to continue to make interesting, creative, beautiful things. And I'm also very confident in humans' abilities to stay a step ahead of the computers, essentially, right? Like, I don't doubt artists' ability to continue to do things that are radical and innovative and beautiful that people have never thought of before. And because no one's ever thought of it, you can't have a computer generate it because it has no pool of ideas to draw on of examples of that thing previously existing. In the same way that we just kind of invented a whole new type of art, a whole new history and chapter of art when the camera came along, I think we're kind of on a precipice of something like that. And that's kind of what I think of when I look at Carly's piece. Carly's piece feels to me like a thing that would be so much harder to produce with AI than a random dragon blowing fire on a forest, flying over a town, or a little gnome with an axe, right? Like, sure, there would be details that would be wrong right now, and whether or not that's fixable, I don't know, argue in the comments. But that piece, the artist's hand is present. And I think culturally, we're going to start to really, really value the idea of the artist's hand being present, because it will be one of the only things you can't fake.
I absolutely understand where you're coming from. The fact that this could create, I mean, we could even take this in a totally optimistic direction and say that the invention of photography freed artists to explore new space that was otherwise,
people have definitely said it,
inaccessible, not because it was literally not possible, but it was just not culturally available. And that AI could, by unburdening us of
making YouTube thumbnails and banner images for blog posts,
could give us all this. Obviously, it will not actually give us more time because we exist under capitalism and it will just displace artists, but we could think of this in the most optimistic sense. But I think that there is something that is absolutely fundamentally different about this technology and photography, which is that
there's a lot of big differences.
Photography is fundamentally a very revealing technology, and it actually completely changed the way that humans perceived the world around them. The classic example is Edward Muybridge, who was the first person photograph the horse in mid-run and see that all of its legs were off the ground at a certain point in its run with high-speed photography. It was really, really advanced technology for the time, and advanced and like thoughtful application of the technology. We can also think about high-speed cameras and the way that they show you the way a hummingbird's wings beat and other things that are just happen more quickly than a human can perceive them. But it fundamentally changes the way that you see the world once you see the way that things are in these sort of, it is sort of like a distortion, but it's a distortion that reveals details of reality, such that now when you look at a hummingbird, you think about the way its wings beat, potentially. Or you see a horse and you think about the way that it runs.
Wow,
way
it's
that
not
is
touching the
different.
Ground.
And as, I don't want to just like pump myself up too much here, but I feel like I've always just naturally been a really curious person.
I think you can safely say that.
And just like noticing details about the physical world and the natural world has always been very natural and very important to me. And the fact that you notice a detail a few times and it sort of eventually you're able to construct this deeper meaning and understanding of reality by noticing those details. And photography is a tool that just fundamentally reveals more details and lets you construct a more true, a more accurate, a more interesting, a more fun image of the world around you. Whereas I think this AI stuff is just not fundamentally revealing. It's fundamentally obfuscating. It's fundamentally confusing. It's just adding more noise to the system, such that when I see an image in all those blog posts in that AI-generated header image, it's no longer a picture that I can notice a detail of in 100 different blog post images and connect it and realize something about the world around me. Instead, it's just obfuscating noise and just will prevent me from actually development, from being a person and understanding anything about the world around me. And that is sort of where I'm feeling this real existential crisis about the development of the way we exist as people in a constructed world where the information that we are exposed to is not based on some underlying fundamental truth, but is instead fake.
Yeah, it's definitely worse than photography in that sense.
Okay.
For sure.
I'm glad you agree.
Yeah, I definitely, photography also birthed a whole separate creative field, which is fundamentally extremely creative and also capable of the kind of revelatory moments like you described. And it's like, it's kind of dumb, but like some of the applications of that, like, have you ever seen the Slow Mo Guys channel on YouTube?
Is it different from any other slow mo guy? Like,
there's take literally a two guys camera
and just point it at something, and we'll like, today we'll pop a water balloon, or
yeah,
today
that's
we'll...
literally all they do. Yeah. But and like the algorithm recommended some dumb videos to me, and I watched.
I've watched plenty of these videos in my life.
I watched them like popcorn at some point. But,
oh yeah.
But then I sort of like, I don't know, they're actually one of the decent channels in the sense that like the two guys behind it, same two guys have been doing it forever, and like they don't buy into all the like algorithm pumping nonsense, and they don't like, they're just like, yeah, we have enough money to buy extremely expensive high-speed cameras, and we have a bunch of people that want us to point them at a bunch of things, and we're just going to like do this over time. And every episode becomes about them learning about how this thing works they didn't yeah. expect, right? Every episode is like, oh, wow, this happens, and you can see this shockwave here, and what are these sparks we just saw when we shot these two glass balls together? And, oh, we found out there's a whole, like, actual phenomenon when glass strikes other glass very hard, you get these, like, jolts of electricity that we capture on camera better than anybody else we've found in any scientific papers online, because they don't have the budgets to, you know, go out into some field in Nebraska and fire glass balls at each other at 500 miles an hour. You're right that I don't think the implementation of quote-unquote AI imagery that we're seeing today is going to become a creative field in the way that photography did. I only think it could be interestingly similar in the way that it will, in your own words, free or liberate artists to, like, do something that otherwise would have felt out of place.
Yeah.
And now what we actually crave societally maybe is things that feel out of place, because it is so easy to make schlocky, glossy, low quality images that are in place, right? That are like part of this visual language that we are so steeped in. Those are just a dime a dozen now. They're like literally you just have them whenever you want all the time. Now I think maybe we'll place a ton of value on those things that are clearly not that. And because there will be cultural, societal value placed on those things, there will be artists that are willing to explore and invest themselves in that space trying to figure out what that means.
I think probably too much about the replicators in Star Trek The Next Generation, which I always thought when I was younger, enjoying Star Trek as one does, that the replicators are just this, like, obviously incredible technology that would be completely transformative and feed everyone, and suddenly society is on this egalitarian plan that can feed everybody. And
just to be clear, because I think it's easy to get these confused, you have the, what's it called when they beam people around? That's not the replicator.
Transporter. Yeah.
The replicator is literally this little, like, hole in the wall mm-hmm. in the side of everyone's quarters in Star Trek where you can just say, replicator, make me an Earl Grey tea hot. And it
exactly.
just...
Exactly. Or make me recombines. A sandwich. Make me a Klingon gah.
Exactly.
Sorry, I didn't pronounce that right.
Gah, gah. And it just recombines atoms in whatever way is necessary to yeah. produce the thing you wanted.
And as I've just been sort of, like, steeping in this confusion about AI, I'm just like, wait a minute, like, actually those, like, human moments when Riker is trying to cook eggs for his friends and it's horrible, like, those are the much more important experiences, and it feels dissonant because that experience had been taken away in that world and been substituted by this manufactured menu of these are the items and this is the way that food is made accessible. And so I'm kind of cherishing the fact that we don't have that yet, and cooking a meal is still like a completely safe from technology art form in a lot of ways. That is so far from true because of how automated our food system is, but still, like,
there's trying to find any recipe on the internet.
Oh God, there's this hand element that just currently cannot be replaced about cooking a meal today that I value.
That's one of the things I love about cooking.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I love about tattoos.
Yeah. Man, did you, what was it on Trash Future or some podcast where they had somebody talking about the automated tattoo machine?
I have not heard that one yet. It must be in my backlog, so I'll get there eventually.
It was, I mean, yeah, it's like, that was a really small, clear illustration about the way that we think about technology in wrong ways, where somebody comes in and is like, I'm a guy that, you know, can get in a room.
That's your first problem.
And I can get money from a VC funder to automate a thing, and look, tattoo artists are expensive and it's a lot of work. What if we just make a tattoo machine? We will use technology to solve this problem. And it's like, they had somebody on that knew a lot about tattoos and could explain all the ways that this technology was fundamentally not going to work. Like, there were problems that could not be solved. Yeah, and we're still like, sold this fantasy of it is inevitable. Technology always equals progress, so you must accept it, because if you are not accepting it, you are rejecting progress. And increasingly, I'm just like, nah, you know, 100-year-old technology isn't a bad thing. If somebody says this is 100-year-old technology, you shouldn't say, well, that's a mistake, we need to fix it, we need to update it. You maybe should say, well, it's battle-tested, it works.
I was going to say, I was actually listening to a semi-recent episode of Well, There's Your Problem Today, where they were making fun of the Hyperloop, and they were like reading press releases or something and saying, like, you know, the trains, this, you know, 160-year-old technology.
Exactly,
and they were every time you hear 160-year-old technology, you should hear technology that's been improved on for 160 years and iterated on and tested. Which is very different from just saying, oh, we invented it once and we literally never touched it again. Because trains are obviously exactly the same now as they always have been. Anyway, I guess that's what we think about the Faithless Looting piece.
Yeah, seven stars.
7 stars out of 2 thumbs. You got it. Well, anyway, that's been a very indulgent episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to hold myself to it, Anthony.
Okay.
By the time this episode comes out, hopefully well before, the playmats I designed and drew with my own hands and with 0% AI.
You got some help from Skelly, the skeleton.
Didn't even use content-aware fill. I used the skeleton for reference. That's different. I drew every single shape myself. Playmats we designed are going to be on sale on our website. It's going to be a pre-order. It's basically a Kickstarter-style thing where you have a manufacturer lined up who's going to produce these for us and in whatever batch we sell. So the pre-order is going to be up. I'm going to probably leave it up for, like, what do you think? 2 months?
Oh.
A month?
2 months seems like a long time.
I don't want it to be so long.
Because if you purchase it immediately and you know you're not going to get it for more than 2 months, that's a long time.
I'm going to leave the pre-order up for a month.
Half an hour.
Is what I'm going to say. For 4 weeks, just to give people enough time to find it and order one or more if you want them. Yeah. I spent a long time working on it and even longer time trying to find a vendor that could produce them consistently and then working with them to get the production right. So
yeah, there have been many, many iterations of, tweaking the way it aligns, getting the colors right through multiple iterations, getting this cool, glossy overlay.
It's got gold foil. So you know it's cool. Anyway, check that out on luckypaper.co/shop. 99% sure that's what it is.
If not, you'll be at a 404 page shop in the header.
If not, I'll edit it. Anyway, that's been an episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you for tuning in. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. All the art for all the magic cards is drawn by an army of contracting illustrators. This podcast is produced by thinking really hard about art and speaking into microphones about it. Have I triggered your existential dread too much on this episode, Anthony?
I mean, what's too much?
Are you going to go home and cry?
Not a lot. Gonna go home.
Think about food.
Stand in front of my open refrigerator and...
That's normal.
Yeah.
Very normal.
It'll be fine. Sorry, Ryan Sachs, for all of the things we got wrong about
technology. Sure Ryan Sachs turned this off ages ago.
Great, great. That was smart.
Ryan Sachs stopped this podcast so long ago.
Like, these guys don't know what they're talking about. Probably not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, art historians also write it and tell us the ways in which we gloss over things too much. I'm curious to know.